Hey, Bible nerds, this is Dr. Manny Arango, and I'm your host for the Bible Department podcast powered by Arma. This podcast follows a Bible reading plan we created to help you read the entire Bible in a year. You can head to the show notes or thebibledepartment.com to download our reading plan and join the journey.
Family, welcome to day 241. We are in the book of Daniel still. We are trekking through the book of Daniel, and today we've got Daniel chapter 7, 8, and 9. Man, if you've done the reading today, then everything that I'm going to say in this episode is going to make total sense because you've got context for it. If you haven't done the reading, then you may want to stop this video, pause the audio, and do the assigned reading for today. It's Daniel chapter 7, 8, and 9. Now, I'm going to tell you right off the bat, Daniel is about to take a confusing turn. Okay. So we are exiting, or we have exited, the first six chapters, which are narrative based, and we are now moving into the apocalyptic section of the book. So from now on, the book is going to feel way more apocalyptic and way more prophetic. Now, I'm also going to give a disclaimer here. On the Bible reading plan, pretty much so far, we've followed a Tanakh ordering of scripture. Now, in the Tanakh, that's the Hebrew Bible. And for those of you who are not familiar with the word Tanakh or Hebrew Bible, that's simply what Christians would call the Old Testament. However, the way that the Jews are going to order their scriptures, for them, it's not the Old Testament. For them, it's their Bible. Okay, they don't have a New Testament. So for the Hebrew Bible, Daniel is not a prophet. And I probably should have said that on day one, but we covered a lot on day one of Daniel. So 2 days ago, which was day 239, we covered a lot of content for the book of Daniel. Now, I'm putting Daniel as a prophet mainly because of the content of the book that exists from this point on, chapter 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. So this is a massive turning point in the book. Chapter 7, in and of itself, is a hinge, okay? It's really a doorway, and we'll kind of get into that later. So I kind of want to just let you know this, that not only are these chapters that we're about to study prophetic, but they would be apocalyptic, all right? Most people would say that Daniel, especially these chapters, the apocalyptic section of Daniel, Daniel, Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Zechariah are the founding fathers of apocalyptic literature, okay? These last six chapters are some of the earliest examples of apocalyptic visions. You can write these down if you kind of want to organize today and tomorrow, okay? We're going to get a vision of four beasts in Daniel chapter 7. We're going to get a vision of the ram and the goat in Daniel chapter 8. We're going to get a vision of Daniel's prayer in the seven in the 70 weeks. Okay, so you'll understand what that means when we get to Daniel chapter 9. And then we're going to get the man in linen in Daniel chapter 10. We're going to get the king of the north and the king of the south in Daniel 11. And then sealed until the end is going to be Daniel chapter 12. So kind of want you to see this. Okay, the book of Daniel can be thought about in six hero stories, and then six apocalyptic visions. Six hero stories. Well, what are the six hero stories? Well, number one, it's Daniel's dietary test. Number two, it's Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the statue. We talked about that on day one. Then three, the fiery furnace, okay? Mishael, Hananiah, and Azariah are thrown into a fiery furnace. And if you're wondering why I didn't say Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because I've chosen not to use their slave names, but to actually use the names that God gave them in the Hebrew Bible. I'm using their Hebrew names, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are names that Nebuchadnezzar gave them to insult them and to ridicule them. And I think it's pretty disappointing, kind of sad, really unfortunate that we know them by these really, really hideous names that either ridicule them as people or exalt Babylonian gods. So instead of calling them by their Babylonian names, I call them by the Hebrew names, which are Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. All right, Hananiah is Shadrach, Mishael is Meshach, and Azariah is Abednego. All right, sorry. That's our third hero story. Nebuchadnezzar's dream being interpreted. This is the second dream of Nebuchadnezzar. In Daniel chapter 4, it's a vision, is a dream of a great tree. That's the fourth hero story. The fifth hero story is Belshazzar's feast and the writing on the wall, which only Daniel can interpret the message. And then last, Daniel in the lion's den is our sixth hero story. So if you're trying to organize the book of Daniel, we got six hero stories right at the start in the first six chapters. And then we've got six visions, okay? Four beasts in chapter 7, the ram and the goat in chapter 8, Daniel's prayer in the 70 weeks in chapter 9, the man in linen in chapter 10, the king of the north and the king of the south in chapter 11, and sealed until the end in chapter 12. Six hero stories, six apocalyptic visions. That's just one way to actually organize the book of Daniel. There's another way to organize the book of Daniel, and this is really all just context clues for today's reading. Okay, chapter 7 is the end of what many scholars would call the Aramaic chiasm. So there's an Aramaic chiasm, and then there's a Hebrew chiasm. You guessed it. The Aramaic chiasm is based on the portion of Daniel that's written in Aramaic. Remember, chapters 2 to 7 are written in Aramaic because the author is, in a very subtle way, communicating that Babylon is trying to rob the Jewish people of their culture, of their language. And in a really real way, they have to speak in Aramaic because they're in exile. But chapter 8 is coming. And when chapter 8 hits, the author is going to start writing in Hebrew again, which is a subtle signal of hope, hope of restoration, that exile is going to be over and they are going to be brought back to their homeland where they speak Hebrew. So there's an Aramaic chiasm. Chapter 2 and 7 correlate with each other. And you've got four-part kingdom in chapter 2, and you got four beasts in chapter 7. We're going to dive into those four beasts in just a bit because that's our first chapter of our reading today. And you got chapter 3 and chapter 6, which is the lion's den and the fiery furnace. And then you got chapter 4 and chapter 5, which is the fall of Nebuchadnezzar because of pride and the fall of Belshazzar because of pride. So that would be called the Aramaic chiasm. We've got a Hebrew chiasm as well, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. All right, so let's kind of walk through chapter 7 a little bit. That's all the context. I'll give you the Hebrew chiasm when we get to chapter 8. But that's our Aramaic chiasm. Let's get into chapter 7. Let's give you some nerdy nuggets because that's a lot of context. I hope that you feel oriented, like that you can organize the book based on the six hero stories and the six apocalyptic visions. Chapter 7 is going to be a hinge. It's our last chapter in Aramaic, but it is our first chapter of the apocalyptic visions. Okay, so it's this portal chapter. It's kind of a transition chapter. It's actually really cool. It's the last part of the Aramaic section, but it's the first part of the prophetic section or the apocalyptic section. Okay, so Daniel 7, there's a vision of four beasts. The first vision is the final piece of the Aramaic chiasm, and as such is a mirror of the first piece, Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the image. Okay, so chapter 7 correlates to chapter 2. It is essentially a vision about the same thing as the dream that Nebuchadnezzar has, four kingdoms or empires that will rise and fall in the everlasting kingdom of Yahweh that will never rise or fall, that is eternal. This time, the four kingdoms are represented by four beasts that come from the sea. This is classic apocalyptic literature. And John in the book of Revelation is going to pick up this apocalyptic way of writing. All right, so in chapter 2, I told you that there's a Maccabean way to kind of interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream. There's a messianic way, and then there's a dispensational way. Same is true for the corollary vision in chapter 7. The Maccabean way to see this is that the lion is Babylon, that the bear is Media, that the leopard is Persia, and that the terrible beast is Macedonia, and that the 10 horns are Alexander III, which is Alexander the Great, the Diadochi, Alexander's successors, Seleucus, Antiochus I, Antiochus III, Theos, Seleucus II, Salicinius, Seleucus III, Sophar, Antiochus III, Philopater, okay, Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, which is the little horn. Okay, so these 10 horns represent these 10 rulers, and then there's a little horn. Okay, that's the Macedonian way to interpret what's going on in chapter 7. So remember, in the same way that, you know, the head, the shoulders, the arms, the chest, the thighs were all meant a different kingdom in chapter 2, the same thing is happening here in chapter 7. Here's the messianic way to see it, is that the lion is Babylon, the bear is the Medo-Persian Empire, not just the Medes, and then the leopard is Macedonia, and then the terrible beast is Rome, and the 10 horns are going to be a bunch of Caesars, which is going to be Augustus, Tiberius, Gaius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero, Galba, Otto, Vitellius, Vespasian, and Titus is going to be the little horn. The dispensational way to see this is that the lion is Babylon, the bear is the Medo-Persian Empire, the leopard is the Macedonian Empire, the terrible beast is Rome, and the 10 horns are the European Union. And then the little horn is the Antichrist at the end of time. Okay. So tons of different ways to see what's going on in chapter 7. But what I do 100% want you to see is this. And this is really going to be, I think, really important. Anytime we look at the Bible and we try to use it to figure out when Jesus is coming back, we're already in bad shape. That's just not the way that the Bible is designed to be used. And so the reason that I tend to veer towards the Maccabean or the Messianic interpretations for passages like this is because these words written to these people had to have real value for them. And if we just say, yeah, man, this is talking about the end of the world, I just think that that's not doing justice to the real people who receive these texts. So I'm going to lean more towards Maccabean and Messianic. But here's the other kind of thing that I want to communicate, is that there will always be new kingdoms rising and falling. Actually, what the message of Daniel is communicating is no matter what empire you live in, no matter what kingdom you live in that is ruled by arrogant, earthly, beast-like leaders, that you are called to be faithful to Yahweh. Like Daniel in the lion's den, or like Hananiah, Azariah, Mishael in the fiery furnace, you are called to be faithful in the middle of empires that don't know God and don't follow God and don't follow the teachings of the Bible. So I don't use these biblical teachings to try to figure out when Jesus is coming back. I use these biblical teachings in order to be Christ-like. And I think that is the big point. And I think anything else is kind of missing the point. But I don't want to get off on my opinion. I just want to kind of add that. All right, chapter 8, Hebrew is back. Okay, we are speaking Hebrew again. And now we're going to get a Hebrew chiasm. Okay, so we're going to get another chiasm. And so I want you to see there are two kingdoms in chapter 8, two kingdoms in chapter 11. Daniel's going to pray for Israel in chapter 9, verses 1 to 23. And then there's a man in linen who fights for Israel in chapter 10. And then there's 70 weeks that's going to get spoken of in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 27. And that is the center of the Hebrew chiasm. And we don't have enough time to really dive into it. But those handful of verses are the center of the chiasm. And let's dive into chapter 8. Chapter 8 is actually some really fun reading. Whereas there's tons of debate in chapter 7 about how to interpret this stuff. And, you know, which beast represents which kingdom. Chapter 8 is actually pretty straightforward. There's a ram and there's a goat. Now, the ram represents Persia and Darius, okay, who's the leader of the Persian Empire. The goat represents Macedon or Macedonia. And King Philip II is going to begin to fight against the Persian Empire, but it's really his son, Alexander the Great, that is going to defeat the Persian Empire. And the vision is then describing how Alexander the Great defeated Darius, conquered the Persian Empire and beyond, but then at the height of his power, died in Babylon in 323 BC when he was only 32 years old, okay? All right, Alexander the Great had four main successors. These are the four horns. that we're going to find in Daniel chapter 8. These horns are the generals that took over parts of his great empire, Seleucus for Syria and Persia, Lysimachus in Anatolia and Thrace, Cassander in Macedonia and Greece, and Ptolemy in Egypt and Palestine. Okay, the little horn that grew later that takes away the regular burnt offerings and overthrows the sanctuary represents the Seleucid king Antiochus IV, who ruthlessly attempted to Hellenize the Jewish people, which led to the abomination of desolation. He actually attempted to slaughter a pig in the Jewish temple on the altar. Really bad. It creates this whole thing called the Maccabean Revolt. This is happening in between the last book of the Old Testament and the first book of the New Testament in what Christians would call 400 silent years. I'm careful to not just say 400 silent years because Jews wouldn't call it that. Christians call it that. And we want to respect our Jewish brothers and sisters, which is also why I say Hebrew Bible and not just Old Testament, if you were wondering. All right. The little horn is Antiochus Epiphanes, who attempted to Hellenize the Jewish people, which led to the abomination of desolation, which was the 3.5 years of temple desecration that led to the Maccabean Revolt in 167 to 164, okay? Which most scholars are going to, that's how they're going to interpret a time, time, and half a time. I actually want to kind of show this to you. In the Maccabean interpretation is going to see the little horn as Antiochus Epiphanes. Time, times, and half a time is going to be between 168 to 164, which is going to be called temple, which is a period of temple desecration. And one like the Son of Man is the people of Israel, everlasting kingdom, the Maccabean kingdom. The messianic interpretation for this is that the little horn is Titus, this Roman Caesar. Time, times, and half a time is going to be from 66 to 70 AD, which is the Jewish revolt, which leads to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. One like the Son of Man is the ascension and exaltation of Christ, everlasting kingdom, the kingdom of God. In the dispensational view, the little horn is the Antichrist. Time, times, and half a time are the final 3.5 years of the Great Tribulation. One like the Son of Man equals the second coming of Jesus, and the everlasting kingdom is the millennial kingdom. So that's, you know, that's a way to interpret this stuff. So I know I kind of went back a little bit, but I wanted to show you that 3.5 year period from 168 to 164 really fits with time, times, and half a time. But that's back in chapter 7, and I kind of wanted to show you how chapter 7 and chapter 8 link. All right, let's actually move to chapter 9. This chapter takes place towards the end of Daniel's long life. He's probably in his 80s. And at this point, in this chapter, is not long before he's thrown into the lion's den. So I know he was in the lion's den in Daniel chapter 6, okay? But this moment in Daniel chapter 9 is probably happening before Daniel chapter 6, which means the book isn't necessarily in chronological order, but it is in a thematic order. Six hero stories, six apocalyptic visions following. Okay, so 6 and 6. And tons of chiasms kind of everywhere. One of the things that's going to mark apocalyptic literature are angels, and we're going to get angels, okay? Actually, we're going to get Gabriel here in Daniel chapter 9. I'm pretty sure we're going to get Michael maybe in Daniel chapter 10. Yes, we are going to get Michael in Daniel chapter 10. The 70 weeks is perhaps the most confusing and debated part of the entire book of Daniel. Once again, each of the three views interpreted a different way. The basic idea is that there would be a great exile that would last beyond the 70 years. But the last 70 weeks of years is just confusing, and no one really knows what it means. So I'm not going to attempt to interpret it. I'm just going to tell you that it's really confusing, and I kind of tend to shy away from explanations that are so far into the future that they're not really edifying for us in our lives today. I think the real crux of Daniel's argument is that regardless of when God is going to crack into human history, that we should be faithful to Yahweh in the middle of evil empires. Full stop, period. All right. One of the things that I really, really, really wanted to highlight for our timeless truth is the power of Daniel's intercession. Daniel is an intercessor. And in chapter 9, we're really, really, really going to see the intercessory call in his life kind of come to pass. And it says this, in the first year of Darius, son of Xerxes. So by the way, all this stuff is dated. We're going to get dates for literally every single chapter of today's reading. And I'll kind of go back a little bit and tell you the dates that we're going to have. There we go. The vision of the four beasts, which is going to be chapter 7, is in the first year of Belshazzar's regency, which is right around 550 BC, 55 years into Daniel's exile. I mean, he was an old man at this point. The ram and the goat takes place not long after that in the third year of Belshazzar's regency, so maybe 547 BC. Daniel's prayer and subsequent 70 weeks happened in the first year of Darius the Mede, which was actually Cyrus or maybe a governor. Either way, it would be the same year the fall of Belshazzar, the fall of Babylon, which was the moment that Belshazzar threw a feast. And that would be the fall of Babylon, 539 BC. So I wanted to just give you some dates for chapter 7, 8, and 9. Okay, 550 BC, 547 BC, 539 BC. We got a different context or different date in history for each chapter that we looked at today. And now, for real, our timeless truth for the day is Daniel's ability to intercede and pray. It says this, chapter 9. Verse 1, in the first year of Darius, son of Xerxes, 539 BC, a Mede by descent, who was made ruler over the Babylonian kingdom in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood from the scriptures, according to the word of the Lord given to Jeremiah. So, also, Daniel knows about Jeremiah, okay? The prophet, that the desolation of Jerusalem would last 70 years. So, he understands that there's a prophetic word that the exile would last 70 years. They're coming up on, I think, 60-something years of being in exile. And so Daniel doesn't just wait around for the prophecy to come to pass. He prays into it, okay? Because prophecy is activated by prayer. And that's not just true in Daniel's time. That's true today. I remember there was a moment in my life where a really, really, really like well-known Christian speaker, his name is John Gray, pulled me out of a room, just pulled me out of a crowd of thousands of people, prophesied to me some of the most accurate prophetic words I've ever heard in my life. And I didn't just sit on my blessed assurance and just wait for it to happen. I prayed into that stuff. Every time I prayed, I began to activate the prophetic words by reminding God, hey, this is what you said. Kind of give me some marching orders. This is the prophecy. What should I do? Okay, so prophecy informs prayer. Prophecy doesn't mean that, you know, God said it, so we'll just wait around till it happens. No, prophecy should tell us how we should be praying. And Daniel models this. And I think this is something that should be modeled for us. Prophetic words are great, but prophetic words aren't just some lifeless guarantee that something's going to happen. No, you have to stir it up. You got to activate it. You got to use the prophecy to inform how we contend with heaven and bombard heaven with our prayers. And that's a timeless truth. I love prophetic words. But prophetic words should not make you lazy. Prophetic words should actually activate you to pray powerful prayers. And Daniel is praying this prayer and gets an angelic visitation. And one of the lasting images that I'll always have of Daniel from reading this book is a prayer warrior. Daniel's a prayer warrior. And I want to be a prayer warrior. You should want to be a prayer warrior. And Daniel should inspire you to be somebody who contends with heaven so that heaven can invade earth. All right. Tomorrow, we've got day 242. We're going to be in the book of Daniel again, chapters 10 to 12. Tomorrow, we're going to wrap up the book of Daniel. I think it's going to be amazing. It's our last day in the book of Daniel. And I'll be right here, and hopefully you'll join me for day 242 on this trek through Daniel, but really a journey through the entire Bible. I love you. If you're on a streak, I'm proud of you. I'll see you right here tomorrow for day 242. Peace. Thank you so much for joining me on the Bible Department Podcast. If this episode was helpful, it would mean the world to me if you'd give us a follow, rate and review the show, and don't forget to share. You can learn more about the show at thebibledepartment.com and find us on Instagram at the Bible Department. If you want to dive deeper into the Bible, you can get free access to our library of courses at thebibledepartment.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow. What if I told you that what you're learning in this video was just the tip of the iceberg? The Bible Department is actually powered by Arma. What is Arma? I'm so glad you asked. Arma is an online subscription-based platform that we designed to help people, everyday people, learn the Bible for themselves. We started Arma so that anybody, anywhere, could have access to trustworthy and entertaining Bible and theology content. In addition to this podcast, we have over 60 courses on individual books of the Bible, on theology topics, and on some hot topics like homosexuality, tithing, and women in ministry. But really, Arma is a community of people that I've gotten to know, a community where thousands of people are currently finding family, asking questions, and nerding out on the Bible together. If you want a community to read the Bible with you this year, or if you want to dive into some deeper theological content, or if you want more exclusive access to me and the entire Arma team, how about you go to thebibledepartment.com. I'll be sure to post the link in the description of this video. Let's make this your year to become a Bible nerd.